This is Thinking About OBGYN with your hosts, Antonia Roberts and Howard Harrell.
Antonia.
Howard.
What are we thinking about on today's episode?
Well, I'm not sure I want to say yet because people might stop listening immediately.
Oh, wow.
Well,
okay.
We'll get to it. But first, what's the thing we do for no reason?
All right. Well, how about iron supplementation for pregnant women who don't have iron deficiency anemia?
Yeah. So, of course, while that does sound absurd on its surface, because why would anyone try to treat non-iron deficiency anemia with iron? Even I've probably fallen into this trap myself, and I know I've seen it a lot around me too, because after all, iron pills are probably one of the most benign ways possible to treat any kind of anemia. And if you think about it, almost every pregnant woman is told at some point that she's anemic, and then she's given iron replacement as a separate medicine in addition to whatever might be in her prenatal vitamin. And I was just looking at one of my old vitamin bottles I still have laying around, and one tablet has 28 milligrams of iron, and that's over 100% of the recommended daily intake for second and third trimester of pregnancy. And that's more than 150% of what's recommended for adults outside of pregnancy.
Right. And that would assume you're not getting any dietary sources of iron, which I'm assuming you do because you eat a fairly normal diet.
Yeah.
So your actual iron levels by supplementing then might be 200% or more what your daily allowance is. So I think a lot of people forget about the physiologic dilution of pregnancy and the fact that hemoglobin levels are supposed to be lower while you're pregnant. In fact, a first trimester hemoglobin of 11 or higher is really normal, but that compares to, say, 12.4 on most labs in a non-pregnant woman. And then in the second trimester, hemoglobin above 10.5 at least is normal due to the physiologic dilution of pregnancy. But again, the lab's going to say that anything below 12.4 is abnormal. And even that 10.5, that number comes from the CDC, and that's among women who are taking extra iron. But in population level studies of pregnant women, even 10 is fairly normal in the second trimester. Unfortunately, the laboratory ranges that you get when you order tests on a pregnant woman, they're not adjusted for which trimester pregnant she is or even that she's pregnant at all. And so the reference ranges don't reflect that. They're the reference ranges for a non-pregnant woman, in some cases a non-pregnant man. And so those hemoglobins will be flagged as low, and people may tell the patient that she's anemic because the number is red. But true iron deficiency anemia essentially makes a red blood cell smaller in addition to making fewer of them. So the blood cell counts and their sizes, or the mean corpuscular volume, the MCV, will also be low in addition to seeing low iron levels if you check those. A standard blood count will show the hemoglobin and hematocrit and an MCV, so you have that information to screen for iron deficiency anemia. Now, the ACOG Practice Bulletin on Anemia and Pregnancy notes that anemia with a normal mean corpuscular volume could still be an early sign of iron deficiency. But either way, the next step would be to confirm that with an iron test. If the iron is normal, then there's just no evidence that having them take supplemental iron is helpful. In fact, there are older studies which show that iron supplementation in pregnancy, just like the amounts in your prenatal vitamin, is associated with increased risk of preeclampsia and iatrogenic preterm delivery associated with the higher rate of preeclampsia. But there are really minimal studies that show that increasing a patient's hemoglobin from, say, 10 to 10.5, if that effect would happen with iron in a prenatal vitamin, that that would have any benefit for the pregnancy. I'll put a link to an article published in February this year in the Journal of Maternal, Fetal, and Neonatal Medicine, which speculates about the increased levels of hepcidin in preeclampsia and some insight into how that might reflect a pathology where excess iron in pregnancy leads to oxidative stress and endothelial dysfunction, which leads to preeclampsia. So it could be that this extra iron supplementation in our patients who are not iron deficient or who are just taking 100% more iron a day because it's in their vitamin, that it could be harming patients by causing increased rates of preeclampsia.
Yeah, so I think the trap is that we do get that universal blood count, 24 to 28 weeks, which is what the ACOG Practice Bulletin also recommends. And then if we see any low value on there, then we'll think, I don't want to stick her again to check an iron level. I could just order some really cheap iron pills for her. What's the harm in that? But besides possibly increasing the risk of preeclampsia, as you just described, I know that iron pills are pretty unpleasant. They can cause problems with nausea and constipation and reflux and stuff. So either I'm prescribing something that they're not going to take anyway because it makes them feel horrible, or they're going to dutifully take it and then I have to chase it with more meds like stool softener or more nausea meds just to manage the side effects. It's all because I didn't just check, is it really low iron or is it something else? So the other idea then would be, why not throw in an iron level in with those same blood counts that we're universally checking, just so that we can have it drawn up front with the same needle stick. And I think the CDC, their phrasing is that they recommend universal iron deficiency anemia screening in pregnancy. So that would go along with that idea. So then the other idea would be, why not just pre-order that ferritin level up front and add it in with those other routine 24-week labs so it can just be drawn with the same needle stick? Because I think the CDC's phrasing is that they recommend routine iron deficiency anemia screening in pregnancy.
Yeah, and we just did two episodes on value-based care. So my first thought is that it would just be very expensive. But you'd think that it would make sense when the prevalence of iron deficiency anemia is as high as it is, maybe up to 30% of pregnancies in the United States, and of course, much higher in developing countries. But the evidence for routine screening of iron levels in pregnancy just isn't there, and that comes from a recommendation from the U.S. Preventive Task Force Service. And I would say we are screening for iron deficiency anemia when we see the CBC and we see the mean corpuscular volume, and then we act accordingly as that determines our next steps.
Okay. Well, when we first started this podcast, one of the things we talked about was doing some small segments on interesting things in OBGYN history. And we have done some interesting bits, but I think we had hoped for it to be more of a regular recurring feature. So I think if you've got anything, you should give us a brief tidbit of something interesting in history.
Okay, well, I don't think we talked about this one, but it's one of my favorites. And I can put a link to an article I wrote a few years ago about this with some pictures of what I'm talking about and references. But this was an article about male chauvinism in OBGYN. And so it's just a collection of a few interesting quotes. One's from a 1934 book called Surgical Errors and Safeguards, which is really an interesting book that I enjoy reading. And it was written by Dr. Max Thorek. And when he speaks of vaginal repairs, he said the following. This is a quote. Cultivate a sense of proportion. Do not leave the vagina too small after a completed repair. I know of two surgeons who were killed by ignorant and enraged husbands who considered their wives' vaginas too small for coitus. It's better to leave them too large than too small.
Well, that's pretty chauvinistic, I'd say.
Do you think that's on his tombstone? That's his motto?
I hope so.
Yeah. So that was the 30s. And then one of my favorite books of all time is a book called Abdominal and Vaginal Hysterectomy by Joel Cohen. This was published in 1972. And in it, he has, when he talks about hysterectomy, he has this sort of week-long thing that describing day by day when the patient's admitted and has her surgery and how the diets advance and all that. So this is a quote from that book. Thus, the patient is admitted on a Sunday evening, has her operation on Monday morning, stitches out on Saturday, and home on Sunday morning. I must admit that on numerous occasions, when the husband is a keen Sunday golfer, I discharge her on Saturday after removing her sutures.
I think I see the chauvinism here too, although I'm not sure why the husband can't just go golfing and have someone else give her a ride. I mean, what's the issue there? But maybe Mr. Joel Cohen didn't, maybe he was afraid of getting murdered by his patient's husbands. So
that's what happened to the other guy's patient doctors.
Yeah.
Tied them up too tight. So it's tough to be a doctor back then. Well, the male chauvinism in OBGYN certainly has not gone unnoticed in our history. So another one of my favorite little things that I share with people is the 15th edition of Williams Obstetrics. We're up to like 23 now, I think. The 15th edition was published in 1976. And of course, in the back is an index. And it has this entry in the index. Chauvinism, comma, male, comma, variable amounts, comma, 1 to 923, which of course is the length of the entire book. So the female index editor of the book slipped into the index after working with Drs. Jack Pritchard and Dr. McDonald at Parkland Hospital, who wrote the book. She slipped this in, and I guess no one noticed.
Guess not all heroes wear capes, but I don't see that in my Williams book index anymore.
Well, I don't think that index editor kept her job for very long. It did eventually get dropped, but not before the 16th edition. So that was published in 1980, and the same index editor put in a similar entry. This one was chauvinism, comma, male, comma, voluminous amounts, pages 1 to 1102.
Wow. So I guess the chauvinism really exploded during that four-year span between the book editions. But now I really want to read both of those editions and see where all those extra volumes of chauvinism are.
It's voluminous. But you know what the best part of the story is?
What's that?
Well, the index maker was apparently Jack Pritchard's wife.
Oh, that's almost scandalous. But I mean, that's classic. Like, of course she would know better than anyone else. So, well, it seems that the women have taken over since then. Because in 1970, only about 7% of OBGYNs were female. But by 2018, that number had risen to 59%. And now over 80% of residents are female. So men are definitely becoming a minority in this specialty. And I don't know how much more female dominant it can really get.
Yeah, I actually thought about this because I had a male medical student recently who's interested in OBGYN, probably wasn't before the rotation, but after the rotation is interested in it. But then ultimately, you probably won't pursue a career in it due to a perception of discrimination against males entering into the specialty. And I think that's common now, unfortunately, at least that perception among male medical students.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think it depends on the setting and the scenario. I think it can still go both ways. I think that programs that want to maintain diversity will reach far and wide to get at least one good male trainee in each new year level. And we've even talked about this a little bit within my program. And there's some male junior residents there who have said that they'll walk into a patient's room alongside their whole team of female senior residents and attendings, and they'll experience that the patient still seems to look to that junior male, the only male in the room, as the most authoritative one, and almost to the point where it's kind of uncomfortable for that male. Like, he's like, I don't know the answers. You look to this person over here. And apparently this seems to happen far more frequently than the opposite situation where a patient would request female-only providers and throw all the males out, which that does happen too, but I guess not as much as we necessarily think.
Yeah, there's lots of things like that in the field that female OBGYNs are often called by their first name by their patients, whereas males are not. So there's definitely many sorts of examples of that sort of sexism in the specialty still, and that sexism coming from female patients. But have you ever noticed, though, how many times you see an OBGYN office, and it'll advertise that all their doctors and midwives and nurses and staff and all that, all of them are female, usually with some tagline like women treating women and something like that?
I haven't really been looking around that much. I think I've noticed that at least with midwife groups. Like there's some home birth midwifery groups in my area that I've looked up because some patients want referrals to them, and I've noticed they tend to be female only. But I don't know that I've necessarily noticed it in obstetric practices, but maybe I haven't really been looking around that much.
Well, or maybe men are more sensitive to this issue.
Maybe.
But I was visiting a city earlier this year, and out of curiosity, while I was there, I looked at the OBGYN practices in that town, and all but one of them made such a claim in their advertisements or on their webpage or whatever. Only one practice, I think, out of, I think, seven in that city even employed a male in any capacity. And the others were very happy to advertise on their websites, et cetera, that they did not employ men, and that's why their patients should go there.
Well, that seems a little below the belt, I guess, so to speak. like if you happen to end up with an all-female practice because that's the majority of who's going through OBGYN training, then I think it's just a little too easy to advertise that. It would almost be like advertising, let's say in Florida, like every provider here was born in Florida and it's a practice in Florida. Like, okay, that's a cool coincidence, but that shouldn't have any effect on the patient care. It's just where they were born. So I feel like that's the same with all female providers. And then I think the obvious problem too would be like, what if someone in that practice retires and now you want to hire a new OBGYN? Just with your advertisements, you've just scared away all of the potential male applicants. And yeah, there, besides maybe making it comfortable for those patients who prefer female only, then there's just no benefit at all to that.
Well, there's actually an ACOG committee opinion, number 510, that was reaffirmed in 2017, although it was written a few years earlier. And it talks about ethical ways for physicians to market their practice. And I'll read you a paragraph from that committee opinion. This is a longer quote. A factual line item stating that a healthcare provider speaks Spanish or Cantonese accurately describes the services provided and would not be considered discriminatory. Conversely, a factual statement that the healthcare providers in a certain clinic are all women may not be ethical if the wording suggests that healthcare provided solely by women is superior to healthcare provided by men. This would be considered discriminatory and therefore unethical in the absence of evidence supporting that claim. If the intent of stating the facts is to imply a value judgment rather than to offer supportable and useful information about access, then even a statement of a fact may be unethical.
Wow, that's pretty direct. I'd say direct against the whole idea of advertising all female. And I think it really is hard to imagine any situation where it would be necessary to state that all of your employees are female. But I've got Google pulled up. So I guess let's look at some statements from some random websites. I don't even know which city you went to, but I'm just taking a guess. So this is a random city. So, and I won't say which one, but here's one that just says, quote, "We are an all-female provider group." Okay, so that seems neutral enough. But then I found another one. The tagline on the website is "Women caring for women." And then again, that's not necessarily making a claim about their quality yet. But then here's some more. Here's one that says, "They're an all-women's group," and then they go on to explain, "Not only do we have an all-female staff, but we serve all women. Like you, we are daughters, sisters, mothers, wives, and friends. We have a unique understanding of the problems faced by women of all ages and a unique approach to finding solutions for those problems." So that's a little bit more implying a value judgment, I would say. And then here's another one that says, "As women who spent time on both sides of the stethoscope," and I don't know, they could have said speculum there, but stethoscope, they say, "we combined empathy with experience to give you the best OBGYN care for every season of life." So first of all, as common as this appears to be now, just Googling it, it doesn't seem that having an all-female practice is really unique anymore. So can't really claim it based on that. But I can see this theme emerging where they're heavily suggesting that their care is superior due to the genders of their providers. And we know that that's a very false suggestion.
Yeah. And there's some honestly more flagrant examples if you look for them. But yeah, I think it's a lot of groups, hundreds of groups in the United States at this point probably are groups of just females. And many of them do point that out in some way to distinguish themselves from local competitors in town. Some are explicit and some are implicit. I think that the first couple you read are certainly just implicit. But yeah, they're competing with other groups by advertising on their social media or their website or some cases billboards that what makes them special or unique or preferable to the other group is that they don't employ men.
Okay, well, I do remember that you said before that you have the preference of going to female physicians for your own care. So if you, with that same preference, were a woman looking for an OB, wouldn't you take notice of a practice that advertised itself as being all female?
Yeah, I did say that. I think you chastised me too. And I admitted that I was sexist in that regard, that I had a preference for female providers. That's a personal preference. It's not a strong preference. If I went to the emergency department with a heart attack, I'm sure that there's many capable males who can take care of me and I wouldn't turn them away. But that being said, none of the healthcare providers that I've ever gone to have advertised on their website or on a billboard or in their marketing material that the reason I should go and see them is because they are female, or that being a female provider somehow offers an advantage over male competitors.
Okay, so hopefully that kind of advertisement might actually like turn you away from them.
I think it might, yeah.
Yeah. And I know in your book that you wrote, you talked about the conversational maxims by Paul Grice. And one of these maxims is relevance. And you explain that this is commonly maybe misused or overused by advertisers. And you gave the example of a Paragard IUD being advertised as the only hormone-free IUD on the market, which is true. It is the only hormone-free IUD in the US, but that doesn't necessarily make it better. But the maxim of relevance implies that the advertiser wouldn't tell us that unless it was relevant, or in other words, unless it was an important distinction. But you notice that they can't actually make any claims of superiority over the hormonal IUDs. So they're just trying to sneakily imply it by this, I guess, maxim of relevance. And our brains are searching for that relevance. And we make the assumption that it must be a good thing that they're hormone free. So that's all to say that this kind of advertising that we're an all-female practice is the same sort of thing, where the consumers will try to find relevance in that and assume that it is relevant even when it's not, and even definitely when it has nothing to do with the quality of the care.
Yeah, I think that's right. And yes, in that example, having a hormone-free IUD might be an important advantage to someone with a hormone receptor positive breast cancer or something like that. But in all the other patients, it's probably inferior to the hormonal IUDs in terms of overall adverse effects. So they don't make any specific claims because the FTC would shut them down. But the patients definitely assume. But back to the female-only practices, there are undoubtedly a subset of women who've had experiences that make them uncomfortable seeing men. But they can self-select in the same way that I do the type of physician that they want to see without the physician building a whole practice essentially based upon this common discrimination.
Unless it's actually true that female OBGYNs are better than male OBGYNs.
Yeah, right. Unless it's true. In which case, we need some supporting literature that backs that up. And obviously, we need to change our whole profession and root out all the men.
Well, just to play devil's advocate for just a second, what is wrong with women empowering other women and making them feel comfortable with their intimate needs?
No, I definitely get it. But essentially, what you just asked me is what's wrong with discrimination? So I'll give you a couple of concrete examples and actually why I was thinking about this because of that med student and how it affects us as a specialty in the field. So first, in a field that's, as you said, now dominated by women, very well qualified and interested male applicants like my student might be discouraged from entering into the field because they see the same things that I'm seeing. They see the billboards on the interstate that I've seen of five female OBGYNs advertising that they're the best because they're female. And their opportunities to do clinical rotations in particular in medical school are really being diminished because of this practice where these practices won't take male medical students. So, and some medical schools have faculty, but a lot of medical schools don't. So particularly those medical schools that rely on community preceptors for rotations, which is more common than it used to be. There are just incredible numbers of OBGYN preceptors who decline to take male students. And it really surprises me, frankly, in this day and age, that medical schools would continue to work with physicians who openly and blatantly discriminate against students based on their gender. I don't think they would continue working with a preceptor who declined to take a student based upon their race or national origin. So the effect of that is any male that still becomes interested in OBGYN and pursues it as a career doesn't have equal opportunities and eventually won't have equal employment opportunities. When I was visiting that particular city, one of the things I was thinking about was, hey, it might be a nice place to live someday. But that's probably partly the reason why I looked up sort of what the job market was like. But with almost every practice in the city boasting about their all-female services, I had to conclude that there was really no employment opportunities for me as a male OBGYN in that city. And to me, that's just extraordinary. That is true in 2022.
That is crazy about the med school preceptor thing. And that's not something, well, firstly, I haven't encountered it because I'm a female, but in any of the programs I've been in, I had not seen that ever happening where any preceptor faculty wouldn't allow a male med student to follow them.
Well, I think it's a difference in two things. So in traditional allopathic medical schools, the medical school frequently employs the faculty members that work in the core student rotations. Although I have worked in an institution where even one of the core faculty refused to take male students. But that being said, in osteopathic programs and nurse practitioner training programs and physician assistant training programs, almost all of their core rotations are scheduled with community preceptors. And so in those programs where there's really a need for good rotations, yes, they're told no pretty routinely in all three types of those programs that they'll take a female student, but not a male student.
Okay. Well, that's pretty unfortunate. Just to try to give some kind of benefit of the doubt here, maybe the doctors who are saying these things, maybe they're not necessarily sexist against that male med student, but maybe they think that they're offering this all-female presence to women, and they assume that's what their female patients want. And it is pretty easy for a lot of groups to end up being all female when there's so many female residency graduates. So maybe if it's one of those all female practices, they think, like, my patient came here because we advertised we're an all female practice. So I don't think they're going to tolerate me having this male med student in the room.
Yeah, I have no doubt that that's true. And I know some of the women who work at some of these practices that do this, and they might even be listening, and I'm not accusing them of being explicitly sexist or anything like that. I think that they have good intentions with it. But my problem is when they refuse to even teach male medical students, and they've closed themselves off from ever hiring a male partner in the future when one of them retires or their business grows, and they are implying in their advertisements that this is an advantage, that they're somehow providing superior care because they're female. That's my problem. And I think my point is that patients are allowed, the patient herself is allowed to discriminate when she selects a physician based on any factor she chooses. And that might be expertise, bedside manner, maybe language, but it could be even gender. It could be race. It could be age. It could be appearance, etc. We can't control what patients choose for. But physicians are doing sort of the entire system a disservice if they play into that discrimination, try to profit from it and validate it and normalize it. What we should be highlighting, if anything, is our outcomes or our training or our expertise or our fellowship training or things like that actually are associated with improved outcomes. If you've done 1,000 vaginal hysterectomies and you want to put that on your webpage, that's great for patients to choose, but we shouldn't be outlining or highlighting these other things. I want my patients to come to me because of my superior outcomes, not because of my age, gender, religion, or anything else.
Yeah, outcomes and experience, right? Those are both part of the quadruple aim. My last little bit of devil's advocacy here, because I don't think this is a good idea, but I think that these all-female practice advertisements might be trying to communicate that they're providing an enhanced experience with those patients in mind who prefer females, but they are erring if they are also suggesting that their outcomes are superior. So that's the end of my devil's advocacy, but just trying to reduce the sheer volume of angry listener emails that you might be getting.
You told me controversy sells.
Well, Maybe you can give us some literature so this isn't just your opinion.
Yeah. Well, okay. So first of all, I would encourage everyone who's interested in this topic to read that committee opinion. These practices are very commonly on the wrong side of ACOG's official statement in terms of the advertising that I see. So this is ultimately just a question of ethics. But here's some other things for you to peruse. I'll put a link to a publication from March of this year that looked at gender bias in the medical education of OBGYNs in the United States. This was a systematic review of literature that had already been published. And they concluded that real and perceived gender bias among female patients and male medical students in OBGYN may underlie the declining numbers we see of men entering into the field. They reported that male medical students were more commonly excluded from clinical opportunities, and that though male medical students reported increased OBGYN interest after their clerkships, that didn't translate into more residency applications. So again, I think this is attributed to systemic bias.
Well, systemic bias can be true, but it can also just be a reality that there's enough female patients that don't want to see male students that naturally feeds those systemic biases.
Yeah, I think that could be the case, but I'm not sure that it's factual. I think that's something we promote in our culture. So for example, in many clerkships or rotations, a physician or a nurse might say to the patient, "Hey, is it okay if a medical student sees you first? It's a male." But they wouldn't do the same thing if it were a female, so that's bias. There's an assumption that males are unwanted in the practice, and they notice that. And that happens not in every practice, so it's also true that that happens in some practices, but not others. Therefore, one questions whether it's necessary. That's what the article means by perceived gender bias. There is real bias among patients, but they can also be biased the other way. They may even prefer males. There are female patients who never want to see a woman. That's a real bias as well. But perceived bias leads us to make discriminatory statements like that, and it makes a very unpleasant experience for the male medical student who's turned down 10 times a day because a nurse asks that question. In the same way, if you have a mixed practice of OBGYNs and a new patient calls for an appointment, it's discriminatory, in my opinion, to say something like, "Well, we have male and female providers. Which would you prefer?" If the patient herself has a preference, she can state it. She doesn't need to be prompted to make a discriminatory choice. So I would challenge you to substitute male and female in those sentences for black and white and see if it feels different to you. And yeah, here comes people are already online. They're writing the hate mails right now, thinking about OBGYN@gmail.com. So somebody will be pissed about that one for sure. But if there is a difference, I would like a good explanation of what that difference is. Why is it okay to discriminate based upon sex or gender, but not on race? It is undoubtedly true that there are people, patients, I mean, who have a racial preference about who they like to see. But I'm not going to feed into that by asking them that question. I can only imagine if a urology group advertised something like men taking care of men and what sort of blowback that would create.
Yeah, well, also urologists do take care of women too. So I don't know how well that would fly over, but.
And gynecologists take care of men increasingly
today
as well.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I'll just forward you all the emails directly. What else do you have on this topic still?
Okay, well, there's also a paper from the Gray Journal from October of 2018 that talks about sexism in obstetrics and gynecology, and I'll put a link to that one. One of the things they conclude is, quote, "Men in obstetrics and gynecology may be negatively affected by unconscious bias and socially prescribed roles for men and women, resulting in patient preferences for providers who are women. Both men and women have a vested interest in promoting greater gender parity in obstetrics and gynecology, and participation of men is critical for realization of this goal. For the obstetrician gynecologist, sexism is not just a women's issue." And I'll say that paper talks about sexism in both ways. It also talks about the gender gap. It's meant to be a balanced paper.
Well, this does seem to be a complete 180 from the chauvinistic age you talked about earlier that was indexed in the Williams 15th and 16th edition. So maybe we somehow need to swing back to the middle with all of this.
Maybe. Chauvinism still exists in the specialty. There are certainly old boys clubs in a lot of departments around the country that are excluding qualified female physicians from appointments and things like that. So I think the point is we should just be fair and equal about it and not go from one extreme to another.
Sure. Yeah. So if we're going to make progress, we should be conscientious about decisions like asking leading questions that are meant to ask the patient to exclude a male from a clinical encounter, or even using advertising that excludes men from joining a private practice, or anything else that we do that might reinforce a popular view that female OBGYNs might be superior when there's no evidence of that. And there probably are a lot of other cultural kind of ideas that promote that.
I will say there there's a lot of different mixed literature about how big the effect is of the female patient sort of being sexist in her choice of a provider. And we could probably spend an hour on that literature, but there are definitely preferences both ways. On the whole, from that literature, it seems that women care more about competency than they do about gender. And most gender biases tend to erode with patient education, degree of education, and with experience with male providers.
Yeah, and I would think that would apply to pretty much any kind of bias. There was a review in the Green Journal in 2016 that found that about 50% of women reported having a preference for female over male providers. 41% had no preference, and then the rest actually preferred male, the minority 8%. Preferred male. So
yeah.
So really, if anything, it's 50-50 for female patients wanting female providers. But as you said, those numbers do appear to change with patient experience. Actually, female OBGYNs were almost 50% less likely to be given top patient satisfaction scores compared to male physicians, which is pretty disappointing. And
these are evaluations by women, not by men.
Yeah. And the female patients did still express the preference for male OBGYNs when it came to surgery, because they're biased in believing that men are more technically competent than women. And we previously discussed on this podcast that that's not true. And interestingly, there was a study of Muslim women where you might expect there to be a religious motivation for them to choose a female provider. But in fact, these Muslim women were less biased than the general American woman was, because only 32% of them preferred female providers, 14 preferred male, and over half had no preference for the gender of their provider. And I'm sure there's probably more to that. I don't know all of the context, but I think it is a complicated topic, and what we do and say culturally will affect people's perceptions and their preferences.
And that applies to society at large.
Yeah.
When we normalize that female OBGYNs are the way it should be in magazines that young girls read and things like that, we're actually just making statements that are discriminatory against males. So I think the Muslim example is great in that it shows that the average Muslim patient was actually less discriminatory than the average American woman. So cultural context matters, and what we say and how we act matters, and the questions we ask matter. And I think that's the point. We shouldn't turn qualified males away from the specialty by creating an environment where they don't feel welcome.
Well, we should probably move on. I'll make a note to get more memory on that Gmail account for all the emails I'm sure we're going to get. But let's move on. I want to talk about the 6-week postpartum visit.
Okay,
so there was a committee opinion from ACOG from May of 2018, number 736, I think, that sought to redefine and optimize postpartum care, and it made some new recommendations. One of them was that the idea of a single 6-week postpartum visit was outdated, and that really at least two encounters are probably necessary more often than not to fully address a patient's needs after delivery. And in fact, they recommended that the first contact with a postpartum provider occur within the first 3 weeks after delivery. And then that would be followed with a comprehensive postpartum visit sometime within the first 3 months after the birth. And the timing of these visits and the nature of them could be tailored to what the patient needs individually.
Yeah, and these sorts of changes that they recommended, it's been nearly 4 years ago, they've been difficult to make, I think, in real life practice. Everyone's just so used to the standard 6 weeks postpartum visit, and maybe an earlier visit only if there's a problem like a blood pressure check or need to look at the incision or something like that. But everybody's stuck in their ways, I think.
Yeah, and there's still a huge number of women that fall through the cracks and don't get any postpartum care at all. I think they said something like 40% of women. It's really easy to just get lost to follow up after they leave the hospital. And so really the first challenge is just getting any postpartum care to more women, just the very basic, that should be the first priority. But then after that, the postpartum care really has to address what they actually need. And if you think about causes of maternal death after women have left the hospital, you should be thinking about maternal cardiac disease, hypertensive crises, substance abuse, mood disorders, overdose, suicide, homicide, and things like that. And obviously some other very important basic parts of the postpartum delivery of care include making sure they have reliable, effective contraception to prevent those unplanned and especially short interval pregnancies. And like we talked about a long time ago, breastfeeding concerns are not necessarily focused on primarily by the newborn providers that they're also seeing. And lactation consultant access may be hit or miss, but feeding is a major part of a new mom's life, most cases. And it's a missed opportunity to help if the OBGYNs are not capturing these patients with appropriate care. So this newer proposed model by this ACOG committee opinion encourages at least 2 visits and sometimes more, depending on what the specific needs are.
And one of the benefits of that being an ACOG recommendation is that finally payers are starting to adjust to it. I know in Tennessee, we have an excellent OBGYN physician that works in the Department of Health, and she's helped get the Medicaid program here to financially incentivize 2 visits in the postpartum period, and that's been helpful. So they pay a little bit more if you get it done, but that obviously provides great opportunities to help women.
That is wonderful. I imagine if you didn't get paid extra for seeing someone after delivery, you might not really feel as motivated to prioritize it. It's not easy. Sometimes these have to be booked out well in advance, and maybe the clinics aren't even open that far in advance. And so it's a process to track these people down and make sure that they're getting into clinics. So it's good that this is being incentivized. And especially with COVID, there's been this huge push to get people away from in-person stuff and do more things over the phone. But if you think about when women are really struggling or at risk for the worst postpartum complications, they really should be seen back within the first 7 to maybe 10 days after delivery. That's when breastfeeding difficulties would be peaking. And many women, by the time of the 6-week visit, if they haven't overcome those difficulties, they'll have given up on breastfeeding a long time ago. They'll be fully dried up. They'll be like, I tried it and didn't work, and now I'm on formula only. And if they had been seen earlier, around that 1 to 2 week time, they might have maybe had some more troubleshooting done. They might have gotten some more encouragement, and that might have led to successful continuation of breastfeeding. And also, the peak of postpartum blues is also around that time, the first couple of weeks. And of course, postpartum hypertensive disorders and many other physiologic, pathologic changes that can occur really are at their height in those first couple of weeks. So waiting till 6 weeks is really just too late, because either you get lucky and those issues just self-resolve, or you miss the chance to intervene early and then the issue snowballs and maybe they end up in the ER with a wound dehiscence, or they have a mental health crisis, or any number of things. So in fact, we take this patient who is used to coming in during her pregnancy every 1 to 2 weeks for a long time and being seen and having her questions answered. As soon as she undergoes this massive transformation of birth with all of the associated risks and pathologic and physiologic changes, then suddenly we tell her, don't come back for 6 weeks. That's pretty backwards if you think about it.
Yeah, if you put it that way, it is bizarre almost. And of course, there's lots of things that need to be tailored to the individual woman. That's what that Bolton spends a lot of time talking about. Depending on her contraceptive choice, she may need to be seen again later in the postpartum period for an IUD placement, or she might need her IUD strings trimmed at that earlier visit if she had an IUD placed immediately postpartum. She may be on hypertensive medications leaving the hospital that might need to be stopped early on as her blood pressure normalizes, or she may develop new onset hypertension shortly after delivery and need medicine started. Those things don't usually just surface exactly at the 6-week time visit for us to deal with neatly there. She may have many practical questions about changes to her body and bleeding and things like that, or new baby problems. She may need help with things like that or be directed toward the right place to get help. And she doesn't typically need all those things at 6 weeks. Like you said, either these things have self-resolved or they've become disasters by that point. She needs them earlier. So she might need subsequent screenings even beyond 6 weeks for diabetes, if she had gestational diabetes, or continued observation of hypertension or cardiology problems or things like that that go even beyond 6 weeks. And many times she needs repeated screenings for postpartum mood disorders.
Yeah. And even with the diabetes, I think we talked before about this study that had demonstrated the validity of doing that postpartum diabetes screen earlier, like even within the first few days after delivery, rather than waiting 6 weeks. But that's probably still not the standard practice in most places. But I think that's just another argument against why do you have to wait 6 weeks for that postpartum visit. But anyway, that committee opinion has a pretty good table in it of all the various components of postpartum care. But I think the point here is that having two visits is really the ideal at a minimum. And I think we have to be really careful about applying telehealth to this because a lot of these things can't really be done that well over the phone. And even if it is a really healthy patient after a really healthy delivery without any issues whatsoever, I think you have to consider whether the patient still wants her appointment done over the phone or does she still want a face-to-face encounter. This is just my opinion, but I think that someone simply wanting an in-person postpartum visit should be a valid enough reason for them to get to have it in person.
Sometimes it's nice just to get a break from the baby and have some help for half a day, honestly. Yeah. Well, you're right, though. The increased utilization of telehealth has been a great developing paradigm shift that we're seeing because of COVID in various medical specialties. And I definitely think that there is a role. And sometimes I feel bad when a patient is driven an hour and a half or something to come see me for a 6 weeks postpartum visit. And I never even touch her because she doesn't require an exam and all we do is talk. But that being said, I think that virtual visits in this regard can be taken way too far. I think they have a role, but that's where we need to think about it and individualize it for different patients. You're kind of looking for the person who is the exception and might benefit from it, not making it the norm. One of the main benefits of seeing a woman a week or so postpartum is checking her blood pressure, checking an incision if she has one, doing a screening for depression or if we're concerned about postpartum depression. The blood pressure is a big issue. And when we look at preventable causes of maternal mortality after delivery and see hypertension and cardiac issues there, the blood pressure benefit is needed. I think that OBGYNs forget that one of the main reasons we see women weekly at the end of their pregnancies is just to check their blood pressure. It's really the main reason. And home blood pressure monitoring has not quite arrived yet as much as the industry would make you think it has. So until we feel very comfortable that we're getting accurate readings at home, there is a utility to having your blood pressure checked in the doctor's office with appropriate equipment by a trained nurse or medical assistant. Secondly, I have real privacy concerns about postpartum visits. Screening for intimate partner violence and talking about postpartum mood disorders while her potential abuser is in the living room behind the veil of the iPhone listening to the conversation, that's a real concern for me. There is a utility in getting the woman to come to the office, hopefully without the abuser, but even if he comes in with her, I have an opportunity to separate them or at least observe body language and their interactions and try to screen for a problem in these situations. And sometimes surreptitiously get a number or contact information to the woman so she can call for help. I can definitely think of some patients' lives that I have, I'll say, saved or at least made a difference in by intervening in the postpartum period in these sorts of abusive situations. And what number needed to treat for intimate partner violence are we okay with? If I detect that 1 in 100, aren't those 100 visits worthwhile? And third, some patients do require physical exam. So examining a C-section incision a week or so later, Well, that requires palpation, not just visualization. Sometimes it requires probing it and squeezing it and things like that. Those patients need to be examined, not merely have a poor quality picture sent over a phone of their incision. And fourth, there's some evidence that virtual visits do not connect well with long-acting reversible contraceptives, which should be our priority. In other words, if I talk to you about birth control virtually, and you're on the fence between a birth control pill and an IUD, but getting the IUD means that you have to come make an appointment and come to the doctor's office to get it, then it's real easy just to say, well, I'll just take the birth control pill. And there's evidence that this has happened in the era of COVID. But if the IUD is something that I can go ahead and place for you right there at the visit, and you're on the fence, and all things being equal, you're here anyway, let's go ahead and get it done, women are more likely to get an IUD. And frankly, even if you decide to get an IUD after a virtual visit and you make the appointment to do that, I have a lot of concerns about the follow through, because what women do is they get on TikTok and search for the IUD, and then they learn how bad IUDs are on TikTok and just cancel the appointment and end up with no birth control. In fact, there's a study about that, specifically that recently, that we should talk about maybe next episode. And I'm sure we could go on with all this, but I think the point is, having one or even both of these postpartum visits to be in person is still very important for probably most women. And I could see where a woman who really truly had an uncomplicated low-risk delivery, it's her second or third child, you have no concerns about her whatsoever, that maybe she would benefit from the convenience of a virtual visit, particularly for that first one. And if so, that should be a week or two out. You could ask her how she's doing and answer questions and talk to her about breastfeeding if she's having any issues, start planning for birth control or things like that. But then that second 6 weeks visit should probably be in person. We physicians, I think, continue to diminish our value to patients. And in the age of virtual visits, that's occurred even more. But what's really happening too, I think, is that as we virtualize these visits, we're not actually addressing all of these things. And the visit becomes less and less valuable, both to the physician and the patient. Then the physician realizes it's less valuable, so they're more likely to do it virtual. And the patient realizes it's less valuable, so they're less likely to even attend or participate because they don't understand why they're there.
I agree. Well, we have time for, I think, just one more quick update. You had read an article from this October's Green Journal about cesarean rates.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite conversation points, of course. So there was a nice study, I thought, where the authors looked at the effect of on the primary cesarean delivery rate in their unit before and after they basically published the nurse-specific cesarean delivery rates. So it's interesting to me how cultural things in units influence the C-section rate and what combinations of unit plus nurse plus physician and all this sort of cultural mixes affect the C-section rate. The things that we emphasize and pay attention to when we manage labors and the things that we are culturally used to in our units and our nurses are used to, they probably have a lot of direction on our ultimate primary cesarean delivery rate. So they recognized that different nurses essentially had different cesarean rates. So what they did was they listed them and told everybody. They started out with a C-section rate of 25.7%. And then after the list was made public about different nurses and people self-corrected and paid more attention to it, they dropped their C-section rate down to 22%, their primary C-section rate. And I'll just point out that that's a bigger drop than we've seen with a lot of other interventions that are recently touted to lower the rates of primary cesarean, like the ARRIVE trial and routine induction of labor at 39 weeks.
For that simple of an intervention to have almost a 4 percentage point drop in the primary cesarean delivery rate is pretty huge. They cited previous research done where the same thing was successful with publishing physician cesarean rates as well. Interestingly, that's study was published in 1988 in the New England Journal of Medicine. They did more than just publish physicians' cesarean rates for everyone to see, though. They also required a second opinion and developed very objective criteria that had to be met in order for the cesarean to proceed. And in 1988, in that study, the cesarean delivery rate had dropped from 17.5% to 11.5%. And those are not just primary C-section rates. Those are total C-section rates.
Yeah, it's amazing to me how far things have changed since that study was published if you think about comparing those rates to ours today. And for the casual listener, I'll point out that neonatal death rates and rates of cerebral palsy and things like that have not declined since that time. These excessive cesareans that we're doing are apparently not helping newborns and children. They're only hurting the mothers. But the idea of requiring a second opinion, I think, sort of went by the medical legal wayside. Trial attorneys took that option from us. No one wants the responsibility or second guessing a C-section that resulted in a bad outcome or something like that when the C-section wasn't done. But the idea of publishing physicians' cesarean section rates and having some objective criteria for cesarean deliveries that, when not met, at least would subject the physician to a review process and oversight of some sort, I think those things make a lot of sense. But it is interesting to me that the most recent publication that they could find, the authors of this new paper could find, that looked at ideas of looking at the physician comes from 1988, which shows that physicians are not really holding themselves accountable, or at least not doing research about it. So I guess we can tie that all together and end our chauvinistic sexist episode by pointing out that the literature was more willing to find fault with mostly female nurses than with mostly male physicians in research about who has a bigger impact on cesarean delivery rates.
Yeah, and I have to ask, like, what does it say about the physicians if it's the nurses driving the C-section rate so strongly? They're not the ones doing the C-sections. It's the physicians doing them. So
that's right.
It's interesting. But I would say in an ideal situation, at least in academic practices, there's usually like a weekly weekly morning report where they actually do review all the strips that usually the ones that resulted in a C-section. And in an ideal situation, those could be criticized if they were overcalled, and that could help lead to process improvement over time. Although that's not always what happens.
That's right. Sometimes. A lot of times there's a defensiveness involved in that. And I think where they developed objective criteria were less about fetal tracings and more about the things in the prevention of primary cesarean delivery rates.
Yeah.
How dilated you need to be for how long and all those sorts of things, where it's pretty clear that you weren't in the active phase of labor, your water wasn't broken for X amount of time, you didn't change your cervix for X amount of time. Those things are pretty straightforward.
Yeah. Well, I think we should end for now, and we'll just check our email inboxes at some point.
Please only send one email. Try to put all of your nasty comments in just one email.
Well, but we will still welcome each and every email that anyone sends us. So anyway, the links to stuff we talked about will be on thinkingaboutobgyn.com, and then we'll be back in a couple weeks.
Thanks for listening. Find us online at thinkingaboutobgyn.com. Be sure to subscribe. Look for new episodes every 2 weeks.